This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
This morning, the question came up, can a person verify the king of samadhi's samadhi? And it's a difficult question, I think. We talked about letters from emptiness and actors playing the part of a person. And the actor feels like they can verify the reality, but that's just an event for the actor, so on. And I think the reason this is such a tricky issue, maybe we can to exaggerate both poles of the argument a little bit to see why it's a tricky issue. On the one hand, the most radically non-dual view that's often, I think, expressed by Dogen Zenji and Soto Zen in lines like Dogen's Bendawa. He says, that which can be met with recognition is not realization itself, because realization is not reached by a deluded dualistic mind, which almost seems to discount anything that can be met with recognition is an object of a person's consciousness. And it's, you know, recognition happens at a certain time and place, and it arises and it ceases. It's just, it's an impermanent experience. So that can't be the unchanging reality of suchness if it's just a temporary experience, right? So in that phrase anyway, Dogen seems to be implying it's not about some recognition of something, that's some enlightenment experience is just a temporary experience happening through a human. And I think so that's that kind of extreme side is sometimes expressed by Dogen like that. And I think that's one critique of Soto Zen by other traditions like Rinzai Zen might point out this problem. Yeah, all the non-duality sounds great, but the problem, if it's taken to its extreme, is that I think Mitsu's question was like, well, what about the path? And what about the actual, didn't something happen under the Bodhi tree? And so on. So it's beautiful because it's so non-dual and so much coming from the ultimate, these kind of teachings, leaving not much to grasp. And I would say that that my teacher, old Buddha Tenshin Roshi, tends to kind of uphold that side of the story a little bit more strongly. I think really trying to stay very true to Dogen's understanding. And it's sometimes frustrating to hear such things. He will say, yeah, of course there are enlightenment experiences and Kensho and all this, but that's not the point. That's not Buddha's awakening. Those are like temporary experiences happening to a person. It's really inconceivable, the all-pervading suchness of reality. So I think it's a beautiful teaching, but its potential pitfalls are then the actual verification can become kind of discounted, and there's nothing to it. This is already it. So it just becomes a faith practice then, since you can't actually recognize reality itself. You just hear the teachings and trust it, and which is somewhat helpful. We align our lives more and more with these truths. So that's kind of one side, one pole, and that's kind of problematic. It kind of discounts the whole path of Buddha Dharma that's all about awakening and this transformation that's possible according to the Buddha and everyone after him. And then can you kind of follow that radically non-dual and therefore sort of not exactly discounting, but downplaying any particular shift, or maybe really the best word to use, downplaying any particular experience that happens in time and space to a particular person. And the other extreme, it's maybe a little more represented in modern times by Rinzai Zen, is it's all about this, it's all about enlightenment experience, having kensho. It's another one of these examples of a Japanese word that's not translated and becomes all kind of mystified. Kensho just means seeing nature, seeing our true nature, seeing Buddha nature, or recognizing. Then it gets made into a noun. It's a verb, seeing nature, but it gets made into a thing called kensho. So you have kensho. You gotta have kensho. But that's kind of bizarre. It's like, you gotta have seeing nature. It's like too many verbs. Anyway, it kind of seems to be emphasizing the breakthrough experience that does happen at a specific time. It's emphasized that it should happen at a specific time, and then it may wear off to some extent. And it's an experience. And the problem with that, right, and this is why Rinzai Zen maybe gets kind of critiqued by Soto Zen, is that we were just talking about an experience happening to a person in time and place. We're interested in the unchanging reality of Buddha that's ungraspable and not just some happy moment. However great the experience is, if it's just a temporary event, the problem with that is it's more of a dualistic setup, right? It's the experience. What we mean by experience, it's an event, an object happening to consciousness, to a subject. It has a kind of, even if we say the experience is about a kind of absence of subject-object duality, it does say if it's an experience that's happening in time and space, then it's happening to a subject. It's an event happening to a subject. So taken to its more extreme, it sounds quite dualistic. So see the problem with both either side of this story, at least painted in their more extreme versions here. Is kind of problematic. It's a very subtle point, hard to talk about. And maybe another way this afternoon, as I mentioned, Dogen uses this image of tasting water and knowing that it's hot instead of cold, is like, in that example, it's a direct sensory experience. It's not a conceptual thing. It might still be happening in time and space when we're drinking the water, actually, but it's less conceptual than just an idea about what hot or cold is like. So it's pretty good. We could say all five senses are non-conceptual: hearing a sound, tasting a taste, smelling a smell, touching a feeling. These are non-conceptual, direct experiences. They're still experiences happening in time and space, but at least they're not just conceptual ideas. So we could talk about this verification, that boundless awareness is verifying itself like, almost like another sense experience. And even these particular questions we're investigating, like the timelessness of awareness, does it come and go? It can be verified that there is an awareness that's unchanging, that supports all the changing experiences. And so you could say this verification of timelessness is like a sense, maybe a strong sense of timelessness. There's a sense of color, sound, smell, taste, and touch. There could be a sense of timelessness, a deep sense, felt sense. It's not conceptual. The conceptual label is right there, ready to be added onto it. But before that label comes, it can be like a knowing, like a knowing of color or sound, a knowing of timelessness that's not necessarily an object of a subjective consciousness. That's where it gets very subtle. You can see it can easily turn into an object of a subjective consciousness, especially in retrospect. You can say, oh yeah, that's it. That's what I've been looking for. The verification of timelessness, but now it's a conceptual label. Can there be a sense outside the five physical senses? Can there be a sense of something very strongly ringing true? Another example might be like, if you love someone, you know you love them, but like, how do you explain that? It's not a conceptual idea, but it's a deep knowing it is so. You could say that there's a verification of love, a non-conceptual verification. And that's actually maybe getting closer and closer to awakening, right? Because that can be something that it seems like it's actually maybe it's not just in a moment. Maybe isn't something that seems to, or maybe does seem to arise and cease, but we'd say, even when I'm not in touch with this love, is it still there if I look for it? Oh yeah, actually it's there. Was it always there? Maybe. So these are just some fumblings around in the dark for this, I think, kind of gnarly issue, thorny issue of verification. Sometimes it's there can be kind of stages of, there can be a conceptual verification of some truth, like we can reason about, well, maybe it actually makes sense conceptually that awareness itself is not coming and going. We can, like, you know, all the models that we're creating in these talks, like they can make more and more sense conceptually. So we can have a conceptual understanding, really true understanding. Everything fits together perfectly. There's no more doubts in the realm of the conceptual model. And then we could call that understanding. And then based on that understanding, we can have a temporary experience, like a more direct, non-conceptual taste, but it still arises and ceases. Maybe just a moment that we could call experience. And then when the content of this moment, the truth of this moment is extended or doesn't fade, it's more like it becomes integrated into our being in a stabilized way, unchanging, stabilized way, and we could call that realization. Understand, conceptual understanding, direct non-conceptual experience, and the extending that or stabilizing that. So it's not just a temporary experience, but it's an ongoing realization, at least like for a Buddha. There's no gaps in the verification. The verification is not like a moment here and a moment there. Understanding, experience, and realization. And I also thought it might be good to talk about this issue of non-duality a little bit more. We have a lot already, but it's good to remember, like, why do we keep talking about non-duality? What's the big deal about non-duality? And here, there are many kinds of non-duality. It's kind of dualistic, right? But I think there are different, you know, non-duality is two different things are not really two. So there's many sets of two different things that aren't really two. Many dualities that are actually non-dual. So the one we're mainly talking about here is the non-duality of subject and object. I think that's the more I consider this, I feel this is like this. This is the central non-duality issue in Mahayana Buddhism. And I think it's good to mention this because we hear non-duality and there's other ones like don't think good or bad. At this time, what's your original face? That's the non-duality of good and bad. And I would say these other non-dualities are derivative, I would say, of the fundamental basic non-duality of subject and object. But this is something we could also explore, especially like say, the non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings. That's very profound Mahayana teaching. And that's a little different than the non-duality of subject and object, right? But I would say the non-duality of Buddhas and sentient beings, in other words, that sentient beings really are Buddhas and vice versa. I would say that insight into that non-duality is based on the non-duality of subject and object, which I think is the root non-duality. You could also say the non-duality of the two truths, the relative truth of changing appearances and the ultimate truth of unchanging suchness. That's another Mahayana Buddhist central non-duality. Again, I would say we can come to that realization based on the non-duality of subject and object. This could probably be a whole week-long discussion in itself. We could, you know, debate these points of which one is prior and so on. But this non-duality of subject and object, if this is the root non-duality, meaning that the sense of subjectivity, like a perceiver, and the sense of objectivity, like a perceived object, that this subject and object that seem like two, it seems separate, even if they're interdependent, they still seem separate. In fact, even in order to be interdependent, they must be somewhat separate, because one thing needs to depend on another thing. So that duality that we take for granted, being taught by the Buddhas as non-duality, that subject and object aren't even interdependent. Ultimately, they're one reality. So ask, what's the big deal about this? Why is this so essential to the project, the Buddhist project of relieving discontent? If it doesn't relate to that, then what's the point? Then it's just extra baggage, as the Buddha is said to have taught something like, I only teach two things. I know there's like thousands of pages of sutras, but I really only teach two things. I teach discontent, you know, and what that is, and I teach the end of discontent. And then all these complex teachings are all only for this purpose. So how is this non-duality relieving discontent? Sometimes we might feel that it's because our discontent is based on grasping objects. And so if we can see that these objects are not outside, objects are not separate from the grasper, then we can't grasp them. And it's really discontent. That could be one way of talking about it. But another way of talking about it could be that this is just an extension, a more subtle dimension of the Buddha's basic liberating teachings from the very start of his teaching, which is the teaching of not self, which I would say is like the central liberating insight in the early Buddhism, and also all the way through. It's like we shouldn't lose sight of the importance of this teaching. And it's, again, and in itself, it's a whole, we could spend a whole week talking about the meaning of that. But basically, is if we're identified with this body and mind as our true self, complete and lasting contentment will be impossible. If we feel that I am this body and mind, which is subject to birth, old age, sickness, and death, and all kinds of other problems that happen to me. In other words, me is the body and mind. That's who problems happen to. Problems don't happen to boundless awareness. Boundless awareness, remember, allows everything indiscriminately and doesn't have a problem. But I, this body and mind and the whole complex package of you know, my whole history as a body and mind, my, you know, ways of my beliefs and views in this personal mind, all this stuff has problems. So there's a body and mind happening, it's going to keep happening, but if we're identified with it as as our true self. That's the Buddha's, if I even had to single out one teaching of the Buddha, that would be like, this is like his biggest gift to the world, I think I might choose this one. And if I am this body and mind, these poems, or if I am some kind of like owner of this body and mind, like a possessor of this body and mind, a kind of manager of this body and mind, a kind of overseer of this body and mind, collection of stuff. I am the owner of experiences. Body and mind is basically a way of saying experiences. If I'm having experiences, this I that has them is like, you know, a personal, individual, some sort of, we don't know what. If it's not the body and mind, but some sort of possessor of the body and mind, then what would it be? This is how we can start to unravel it. But if it's even just like the whole totality of body and mind together is the possession, is the possessor of its parts. Any of these versions, we feel like either I am the body and mind, or I'm the possessor and overseer and manager of the body and mind. Lasting and complete contentment will be impossible, the Buddha teaches. So that's why the teaching of not self is, I am not this body. I am not these feelings. I am not these perceptions. I am not these habitual patterns. I'm not the personality. I'm not even dualistic consciousness arising and ceasing in this individual way. And if I am those things, or if I even have those things, we sometimes talk as if we have them, right? This is my head. It's not like the head is me, but I have a head. Language talks this way, right? But even thinking that I have a head, or I have a body, and I have feelings, and I have thoughts, this is the root of suffering, of discontent, according to the Buddha. So, but there's no mention of non-duality. So I could say this basic central teaching of what is not self, we could say, even if we feel like I am not this body and mind, actually. There is a body and mind, and there are thoughts, and there are eyes and ears and so on. And then there is a world out there of colors and sights and so on, called objects separate from the subject that sees and hears them. You say that's duality, right? But it could be that I am not these eyes and ears, and I am not this body and mind, but there is a body and a mind, and there is a world separate from the body and mind. I would even say that would be one way to look at the early Buddhist teachings. The central insight is just don't identify with this body and mind, but it's not saying that there's not a world separate from mind. It's not emphasizing non-duality in the early teachings. And the Buddha taught that we can be completely free from suffering just by not identifying with this body and mind. Even if it's a real physical material body made of flesh, blood, and bones, and there's a real world out there made of like rocks and trees and atoms, and they're separate. They're interdependent, but they're like two separate realities. It's called duality. We can still be free as long as we're not identified with this body and mind as ourself. Can you understand? There is a body and mind, but we don't think it's myself. It's just a it's just stuff happening, just like the trees and rocks happening. But we can be quite free that way. And then you might say, then why bother with this non-duality issue? And one way to understand it would be that it's a more subtle teaching of the not self. So like this, that I am not this body and mind, but if there's still a feeling that there's a perceiver, that there are eyes and ears and perceiving, there's perceiving of a separate world that's perceived, that's duality, without the body and mind being self. But there's still in that duality, the sense of the world being outside, external to the perceiver, may create a very subtle sense of separate self still. In this case, the separate self is not the body and mind per se. It's just the perceiver. We start to identify with the perceiver. I'm not a body and mind, but obviously there's eyes and ears and stuff over here. And that perceiver starts to become a kind of a subtler version of separate self. This is one proposal for why the Mahayana tradition said, we want to investigate even more deeply this issue of separate self and see if, because it's so easy to impute one, to imagine one. We're so prone to imagining one that even if we see, I really have seen through grasping this body and thoughts and five aggregates as myself, maybe there's still some sense of perceiver. As soon as we have a perceived object, that split of duality is not so much maybe about not grasping the objects. It's more that as soon as there's objects outside, it creates a sense of somebody, some kind of perceiver separate from the world. It's, I think, a very subtle sense of separate self created by the illusion of duality. So that's why these Mahayana teachings go so subtle. They're really going deep into how perception works. It's to kind of, route out any like traces of identification with a perceiver that's separate from the perceived world. That's a little clunky. It's a little hard to talk about. But I don't know if you could follow this point. The conclusion being that maybe the emphasis on non-duality in the Mahayana traditions, including in Zen, there's a lot more talk about non-duality, I would say, than there is about no separate self. And maybe this is because it's like dealing with this very subtle origin of discontent. These are some kind of complex ramblings today about the importance of non-duality. If we're going to be really devoted to understanding something, we better have a good reason for it. And it better be about relieving suffering, or else we don't have time to, I don't think we have much time left in this life to there's so many things we could learn about, right? What about being free? And so we can then spread such freedom to others. It's not just a personal thing, the Mahayana, right? We want everybody to be free, and it's no easy matter. So we're looking at Dogen's envy this week, and his Vipassana instructions. And of course, this essay is not the only one. And so just to mention a couple other places I found that sound similar to this essay in Dogen's teachings, that are kind of complementary, I think, to his teaching, and to see how he was often considering these issues. So this is an essay by Dogen called Shobogenzo Jobutsu Yuigi, the awesome presence of practicing Buddhas. And it's a long essay and it says a lot of other things, but this phrase caught my attention. Dogen says, to understand the meaning of totally surrendering, we're talking about this morning, you know, like surrender, can the separate self surrender to big mind? Can small mind surrender to big mind? Here, Dogen says, to understand the meaning of totally surrendering, you must thoroughly investigate mind. And I didn't look at the Chinese here, but I'm assuming that thoroughly investigate is the same characters, Sanju, that Dogen uses all through the Shobogenzo. And it's a very good literal translation, thoroughly investigate. It's in this week's essay too, right? To understand the meaning of totally surrendering, you must thoroughly investigate mind. In the steadfastness of thorough investigation, all phenomena are the unadorned clarity of mind. That's a beautiful phrase about non-duality of subject and object and the thorough investigation of that, that is also called total surrender. I'll read it again. To understand the meaning of totally surrendering, you must thoroughly investigate mind. In the steadfastness of thorough investigation, all phenomena, all things, are the unadorned clarity of mind. There's a lot packed in there. But the basic gist is when we thoroughly investigate mind, we can come to the conclusion that all phenomena, all external objects, experiences happening to the mind actually are the mind. And more specifically, how are they the mind? They are the unadorned clarity of mind. We could say that the clarity or luminosity of mind is what expresses itself as the 10,000 things. It's not so much the boundlessness that is the manifestation of objects, it's the knowingness, the clarity aspect of mind, the Sambhogakaya aspect that is the appearance of phenomena. Mind takes the form of colors and sounds and sensations and thoughts and so on. All these phenomena, mind takes the form of them. The clarity aspect of mind is what we mean by all phenomena. That's a juicy phrase in this essay. Here's another related Dogen saying from Shogo Genzo, Shinjin Bakudo, body and mind, study of the way. Dogen says, views about the one mind differ among beings. Views about the one mind, I think we can understand this as the boundless presence, or zamai or zamai. Views about this differ. We might have different views, quite similar, slightly different. Views about the one mind differ among beings, yet these views are nothing but mind. And then Dogen has some vipassana, inquiry questions. Once we accept this, he's asking us to ask about the mind. Views about the one mind differ among beings, yet these views are nothing but mind. Is it, the mind, inside or outside? Does it come or go? Is there more of it at birth or not? Is there less of it at death or not? How do you understand this birth and death? These are some questions Dogen asks, and I think a very similar feeling of like inquiring into this very mind. Very similar questions too, right? I think, is it inside or outside is very much related to, are these phenomena that he said in the other essay, these phenomena that are the clarity of mind, these walls, tiles, and pebbles that we see, are they inside or outside? The question is the mind inside or outside? Well, the mind is inside. Well, then you mean those pebbles out there are not the mind, or are they the mind? And is there more of it, you could say, at birth, you could say during life? The Chinese character for birth and life is the same. You could say, is there more of it during life and less of it at death, this mind? And how do you understand this birth and death? So Dogen's, I think, pretty into Vipassana. He doesn't say, in this case, at the very time of sitting, you should ask these questions. I think that's what's truly unique to this Zamai or Zamai essay. He really explicitly says, at the very time of sitting, you should investigate these matters. So in this essay, we reached the point where we now know without doubt. He hopes. Are we verifying beyond doubt? He says, we now know without doubt that cross-legged sitting is in itself the king of samadhis, samadhi, the entrance into realization, it says here. And remember, going back to this point of kekafuza and cross-legged sitting, could be interpreted as just the meditation posture, the posture of zazen, whatever posture that is, doesn't have to be cross-legged necessarily. So we could say, we now know without doubt that this meditation posture is itself the king of samadhi's samadhi. The entrance and verification, we could translate it. Remember, this is referring to the treatise said, if you want to enter this samadhi, and Dogen added in, if you want to enter and verify the samadhi. So here he's reiterating that and saying, but in this case, he's bringing in this other element, that this posture is itself the king of samadhi, samadhi, which is the entrance and the verification. You could say of the king of samadhi, samadhi. The posture is the entry, and he would say, well, we can even cross that out if you like, because this is not a samadhi, you enter and exit. But maybe the main point is verification for Dogen. This sitting posture is the king of samadhi, samadhi, and the sitting posture is the verification of this king of samadhi, samadhi. You could hear it like that. All samadhis are, here it says, subordinate to this king of samadhis. Really, that character means more like family or relatives, which I think is nicer way to put it. All other samadhis are like in the family of the samadhi. But maybe there's some like king analogy going on here, that all the other samadhis are like the subjects of the king. Cross-legged sitting, or the meditation posture. Here it says, is the body of suchness, the mind of suchness, and it's this whole list of suchnesses, which I'm not sure about that. Maybe that's a nuance of this Chinese character that I'm not familiar with, but this character, Jiki, usually means upright, even vertical. And sometimes used for like upright sitting. So that seems the more literal translation that I think is nice and a little more tangible, maybe. So I would put it as cross-legged sitting is the upright body, the upright mind, the upright body and mind, the upright Buddhas and ancestors, upright practice and verification, upright crown of the head, upright direct life vein, which is translated here as Dharma lineage. In that case, it's in Japanese, Myo Myaku. Name of one of our Dharma brothers. Myo Myaku means life vein, and but it's usually referring to like the lineage. Kechi Myaku is the blood vein, or the blood lineage of ancestors, and this is kind of a synonym for that, the life vein of Buddhas and ancestors. So this meditation posture, Dogen's just praising cross-legged sitting. It's the body, it's the upright body. So that's kind of literal, right? It's the upright mind. It's the upright body and mind. It's the upright Buddhas and ancestors. It's the upright practice and verification, which we've been talking about. Sweet. It's the upright crown of the head, which is seems to be a kind of Zen phrase for like the pinnacle of truth. And it's the upright life vein of the Dharma lineage. And then Dogen says, here the translation is, bringing your present human skin, flesh, bone, and marrow together, you form the king of samadhi's samadhi. But I think it misses some of the creativity of Dogen, this translation. It's more literal. It's got the keka. It's got the keka. Keka fuza. I mean, literally means crossed legs, right? So this translation doesn't mention this, the posture, right? So literally it's more like crossing the legs of your present human skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. You cross the legs of the king of samadhi, samadhi. That's more the wacky Dogen we know and love. Crossing the legs of the king of samadhi, samadhi, and crossing the legs of this present human skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. Crossing the legs of marrow. So I think that's a great sentence. So it's like his kind of non-dual bringing together. The posture, right, is the very tangible emphasis on the actual upright meditation posture. And then that's, it's being like expressed as the actual samadhi. So that's a kind of non-duality of like this ordinary body sitting in a posture is boundless presence, which is very similar to non-duality of subject and object, or that the meditation posture is appearing within boundless presence. Boundless presence allows upright cross-legged sitting to be expressed. And it also allows slumping and snoozing, because everything is allowed by boundless presence. But here Dogen's celebrating the unity of the personal human upright posture and the boundless impersonal presence. And this skin, flesh, bones, and marrow is a phrase that shows up a lot through the Shobogenzo. And it seems to be the origin of this set of four body parts, is they're kind of like depth, right? Skin, flesh, bones, marrow is kind of deeper and deeper into the core. And seems that the origin is the story of Bodhidharma with his four disciples and saying, now the time has come to express your understanding. And they each offer beautiful poetic expressions of where they're at. And you can read them. The first three offer these beautiful poetic expressions. And when the first one offers, Bodhidharma says, you've attained my skin. Wow. You are me. Next one does a statement in Bodhidharma says, you've attained my flesh. Oh, even deeper. The next one says a statement in Bodhidharma says, you've attained my bones. And finally, Hueka, who is the second ancestor, became Bodhidharma's successor. His expression is just to silently bow. He doesn't say anything. And Bodhidharma says, you attain my marrow. And historically, we see Hueka as the is the main successor of Bodhidharma. So its story is easily read as these were all great statements, but there's a degree of shallow and deep. Dogen has this whole essay where he non-dualifies that. It says skin, flesh, bones, and marrow are all equally, completely, perfectly complete. In this easier way. Anywhere he finds any duality or discrimination in these Zen stories, he likes to level it out. So it's a kind of thing of like deeper and deeper and deeper, but for Dogen, it means also all equally and perfectly deep. So, and then why did he bring up this image in this case? I think it's because he's talking about this human physical posture. So it fits very nicely into the Zen image of skin, flesh, bones, marrow. So crossing the legs is like a very like just ordinary physical bodily postural thing. So Dogen says, crossing the legs of your present human skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, you cross the legs of the king of samadhi. You could say it's like this is form itself is emptiness in a very poetic way. It's bringing in this whole story of Bodhidharma's transmission to his disciples and the body and mind and one suchness. Dogen goes on, for world honored one always observed or always maintains cross-legged sitting, the meditation posture. He correctly transmitted it to his disciples as well. He taught it to humans and devas. It is in and of itself the correctly transmitted mind seal of the seven Buddhas. So this is a Dogen-like talk. The seven ancient Buddhas are, this is back in the Pali Canon, Shakyamuni Buddha, at one time said to the assembly, "Yeah, I'm not, I know you all think I'm like the first Buddha around here, but I'm not the first one." Right? There were these six other ones. So Shakyamuni is the seventh. Now we can say the seven ancient Buddhas because even he's ancient. And he describes, they all have names, and he describes like their parents' names and how they sat under trees and realized, verified the way. And and we're talking about past eons, like not a few years ago, but like in, you know, eons ago. And so it's a beautiful teaching about the timelessness of the transmission. It didn't start on 500 BC. That's super recent. This started like eons ago. And it's in these early teachings. And Zen tradition became, of course, very interested in lineage. So we include these six Buddhas before Shakyamuni. When we chant the names of the lineage, right? Bashibutsu Daiyosho, Shikibutsu Daiyosho, Bishafibutsu Daiyosho, Kurosonbutsu Daiyosho, Kunogonmonibutsu Daiyosho. Kacho Butsu Daiyosho, Shakamonibutsu Daiyosho. That's a clunky transliterations of the Sanskrit names of the ancient Buddhas. And then we have the Buddhas of our world system, Kashyapa, Ananda, and so on. I love that we chant the names of the seven ancient Buddhas to kind of like emphasize the beginninglessness, almost like beginninglessness of our lineage. In fact, there's even more before these seven in other early Buddhist texts, Pali Canon. They go way back, right? Like Dipankara, I think, was that first meeting of the one who would become the Shakyamuni Buddha, was like kind of served Dipankara Buddha, and that was his setting the beginning, the developing the merit to become Shakyamuni Buddha. So it's like, you could say seven Buddhas, it's kind of beginningless lineage. And we're talking about the correct transmission of the mind seal. Dogen likes that Shoden, correct transmission. Even on our, many of you have the Kechi Myaku blood lineage document. And on this document, it says, let's go. Bodhisattva, great precepts. Buddhas and ancestors, correct transmission. Buso Shoden. This is the correct Sho is like Shobogenzo, like the true, authentic transmission from the Buddhas and ancestors. That's like a little Dogen flavor on these lineage documents. The authentic transmission of the seven Buddhas. Dogen's really into this transmission of the lineage, and so it comes up in a lot of the Shobogenzo. But here, of course, what is being transmitted authentically by the Buddhas and ancestors, going all the way back to the seven ancient Buddhas? Well, cross-legged sitting, or the meditation posture. That's the essence of the authentic transmission of the Buddhas and ancestors. It is referring to cross-legged sitting, which we also hear that this is the boundless presence of the King of Samadhi. Well, that I can understand, he's transmitting boundless presence of King of Samadhis, just like a posture is the essence of his authentic transmission. Here Dogen says, well, these are non-dual. Crossing the legs of your present human skin, flesh, bones, and marrow, you cross the legs of the King of Samadhis, Samadhi. And this cross-legged sitting, this boundless presence of King of Samadhis is in and of itself the authentically transmitted mind steel of the seven ancient Buddhas. Any questions? Or clarifications about any of these points, including the thorny issue of experience that happens at a time and place to a human and how limited that is. And yet, if we don't talk about any such thing, then what are we talking about at all? What's the path? Goren-san.
Thank you. I think this question falls into that last category of what is the path, but
hold on, I can't wait here.
It seems like Soto Zen has a I don't know, this is my sense. It could be incorrect, but it sometimes seemed like the way that you practice with non-duality is by paying total close attention to particulars, like very carefully and very in-depth. And then with the little bit of experience of Rinzai that I have, it seems like that's more kind of like maintaining the energetic flow, like really not so particular, not so concerned, but kind of maintaining that more global dynamic awareness. And it seems to me like one of the dangers of the careful attention to detail is that you can get lost in particulars. You can kind of lose a sense of the ultimate in a way. Yeah, so I just wanted to see, yeah, does that sound accurate, or, and then what would you think?
Yeah, that's a nice point that we haven't brought up yet, of looking at these different other different ways to approach non-duality. We haven't really talked about exactly that way, but I think that's a great way to distinguish Soto and Rinzai style. We have this phrase, Menmitsu no Kafu, that referring to Soto Zen. Menmitsu is like literally like the intimate weave of fine cotton, like so finely woven cotton, but literally, but like the colloquial kind of meaning is like very careful attention to detail, menmitsu. And Kafu is like the wind of the house, or the style of the Soto lineage. The style of the Soto lineage is careful attention to detail. Yeah, it has been said since ancient times. And I think there's a phrase like that for Rinzai Zen, I'm not quite sure what their Kafu, their house wind is, but one list I've seen from China is something like, I can't remember the words exactly, but something like vigorous dynamic energy, or like it maybe even like hitting and shouting, I mean, which is in the early Chinese Linji lineage, that was Linji really like formed that style, almost became cliche, like he would shout as just an answer to questions, and then his disciples started shouting. So that's a different feeling, right? Just in those images, from careful attention to detail. And like you said, we can get too bogged down in the detail. In Soto, that's the danger in Soto. And I think it was Tangen Harada Roshi, old Buddha, my teacher, Bukokuji, who I think either I asked him or he said this, it was long ago, but I have this note that was like, the question somebody asked was, can you realize awakening with just Shikantaza? So Tangen Roshi was a Soto lineage teacher, but he had this whole Rinzai element. It was really a total hybrid, Soto Rinzai hybrid. Technically Soto, but he's the Dharma brother of Yasutani Roshi, who really brought that hybrid to the West. Their mutual teacher sort of founded this style. So he was an interesting one to ask this to. Maybe just a Soto teacher would say, of course, that's our practice, but he was offering koan practice. So someone asked, can you totally verify the way with just Shikantaza without using koans to kind of create a kind of breakthrough? I think it was this implication. And his answer was, yes, you can, if you're very careful not to get nitpicky. I think is how it went. In other words, like, I think it's, there were maybe a little more to the story, but I think it was like the Soto style of careful attention to detail is, that is a way to realize non-duality. Like you just brought up, like you're just really attentive to each task one at a time. And he said, the problem, the danger with this, he said, is you can become nitpicky. This was the way of translator, of course. And I don't know what the Japanese was, but I think that was a great teaching. And I can see San Francisco Zen Center style, right? People can get so nitpicky about the particulars of ceremonies or something that they can get like caught up in it and argue about the forms and like we're missing the point, right? So yes, you can just sit and pay careful attention to each thing, but don't get nitpicky about it. Kind of neurotic or OCD about it. And then the danger in the Rinzai side would be, one danger would be if it's just not enough careful attention, then it becomes kind of careless and almost reckless, rough and reckless. That might have been the actual Chinese phrase for the Linji school, something like rough and ready or something, and which has a kind of vigor to it, like you say. But and we need vigor, and maybe we need some rough and ready to not be nitpicky. It's kind of the opposite of nitpicky, right? Dangers and opportunities on both sides. But that's a nice point that you bring up about both careful attention to each thing is a way to verify non-duality. Like there's no extra conceptual elaboration going on when we're so immersed. Geronos is from tea ceremony. Maybe you would say you can really verify non-duality in the careful attention of tea ceremony, where there's not a lot of extra, figuring anything out. It's a bodily carefulness with detail. Yeah.
Well, and somehow totally entering into duality in a way. That's what I was thinking, is some like totally honoring it not trying to dissolve it, but somehow trying to go through it.
In a way, attention to detail, the details we're talking about are objects. That's what we're not, I think that this careful attention to detail is not about the details in our mind. We're doing that, this machine, we're getting into mind details. But the careful attention to detail here is external detail. And it looks dualistic, but with this, the subject and the object interacting more and more intimately until there's no separation. The way they exactly plant the incense vertically in the center of the vessel is, there's nothing extra, nothing lacking. There's no assessment of how it's going. It's just embodied expression of non-duality. And there's no even thought about, is this non-dual? That would ruin it. But then afterwards, one might feel that that ceremony, I lost my sense of self in the detail of the ceremony. But that's, we earlier were saying, modern, really Soto and Rinzai, I think, monasteries, but definitely Soto. There's more time spent perfecting the details of ceremonies than sitting zazen. And we might say, well, that seems silly, aren't they missing the point? But I think you hit on the point of why, one reason why there's so much attention to the details of ceremonies and cleaning the temple and so on. Yeah, realizing non-duality through what appears to be like really working with objects. Yeah. And we could say this paragraph we just looked at from Dogen, maybe emphasizing the same thing. Like he's really trying to bring together these two points he's been talking about in this essay of cross-legged sitting or the precision of the meditation of a particular meditation posture, and then his boundless presence that's inconceivable and not physical. And so he's saying they are, this is maybe kind of the culmination here. These are non-dual. These are different names for the same reality.
Yeah, Kokyo.
Oh, yes.
So when we take this meditation posture, we actually get a front row seat, don't we, of the King of Samadhis, each of us.
A front row seat. We take this seat and this very seat is always the front row. Yeah. Yes.
So I wanted to follow up. I liked what this teacher said about that. Be careful of getting nitpicky.
Yeah.
And this awareness allowing that Giroux brought up as opposed to awareness affirming. Maybe with the affirming mind, there's less nitpicking.
Hmm. Could be, or it could be the other way around too, right? Could be that allowing is more like it's okay like that, or you want to do it like that, that's okay. Whereas affirming might be like, it's like this, and like, don't do it like that. So depending on how we're using the words, you could hear it either way. We're playing.
Yeah, I was imagining it like the sun. Does the sun affirm the flowers that it shines on? And there's no getting in the way with that kind of affirmation. So I guess the allowing or the affirming, it's basically your awareness isn't getting in the way, or you're letting not in the way.
Yeah, it's a nice pair of words, affirming and allowing, right? And you brought up a nice image there, like the sun affirms the flower. We could say that. And we can also say that the sun allows the flower. Maybe that the flavors of these words is allowing, sounds a little more passive, right? It's more like, it's allowing sounds a little more non-doing, and affirming sounds a little bit more active, just these words. And both are important, right? Again, as soon as we set up a duality, then falling to either extreme, where we get stuck. So if it becomes too passive, like there's nothing to do here, and just allowing distractions could be like this boundless presence is allowing all kinds of distractions, and it does allow that. But then if we get too into that side, I was like, well, just let them come because everything's allowed. And then we just wallow around in distractions. And then the affirming side might be like, and this boundless presence is affirming the presence. And that might be helpful when we get too into allowing distractions. It might be nice to affirm some presence. But then if that becomes too heavy-handed, then maybe we switch the term back to allowing. So it's nice with these two words that we were exploring if they're kind of saying the same thing, and they may be like a little different flavor, affirming and allowing the non-duality of affirming and allowing is radiating quiescently throughout the king of samadhis, samadhi, for the benefit of all beings. And we dedicate the merit of this samadhi to all beings throughout space and time. May they be free of all extremes. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.